You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Possible alternatives to work and income include the idea of a universal basic income that has gained traction in recent years. I spoke with Chief Economist at the New Zealand Initiative, Dr. Eric Crampton, about the possibility of introducing a universal basic income and its possible effects on the welfare system. I began by asking him to explain the concept of a universal basic income.
A universal basic income is almost explained by its title. It's universal, so it covers everyone. It's basic, so it's at a level of income that, well, isn't extravagant, but should be enough to cover the basics, and it's income. So it's a transfer payment from the government to each person in the country.
In your article, you describe the current welfare system as containing poverty traps. Could you explain this?
We have a pretty clean income tax system with without very many exemptions and with only a few levels of tax rates. The problem that we've got is that we have a lot of income contingent benefits. Now, it's both a problem and a solution to a problem at the same time. On the it's a problem side, if you're earning certain levels of income, so if you're on, say, minimum wage work at maybe 20 hours a week, and you're on a lot of income-linked benefits, like working for families because you've got kids, or other benefits that get clawed back as your income increases, you don't get to keep very much of any extra dollars that you earn. So if you shift to going to 21 or 22 hours per week, you might only get to keep 10 or 15 cents on the dollar from every additional dollar that you earn. So we'd call that the effective marginal tax rate. The effective marginal tax rate combines the income tax that you pay with all of the clawbacks from any income-linked benefits that you're receiving to say how much of the next dollar that you earn gets clawed back or taken by the government. Now, we are always facing hard trade-offs with these kinds of things. The income-linked benefits are there for a reason. They try to target limited state aid to those who are in the very most need, and that requires then a lot of questions about your income, a lot of questions about your personal circumstances, and a lot of the kinds of things that people find really intrusive. So during all of the debates around Materia Ture's benefits when she was younger, well, there was a lot of focus on the intrusiveness of the questions that she faced and how it's really not very nice that the government's going to be checking in to whether you're living with a partner or not, whether your partner's supporting you, whether you're getting other support from family members. The whole reason for all of that, though, is to make sure that what money the government does give to people is targeted to those who are in the worst circumstances, so that a dollar is going, instead of to somebody that has some family support, to somebody that isn't able to rely on family in that way. A universal basic income does away with all of that. There aren't any intrusive questions, but the trade-off with it is that everybody pays a much higher tax rate in order to be able to afford to provide a basic income to everyone, and it can never be as generous as the benefits that are provided under targeted assistance to those who are in the most need, because otherwise the budget just immediately explodes. It's impossible to pay everybody in the country as much as is paid to some who are in really terrible circumstances. So if you've got lots of kids with disabilities and you're a single parent and you are yourself disabled, you're going to be getting a lot of assistance from the state as compared to somebody who is in less dire circumstances. You just can't afford to give that amount of assistance to everybody.
What do you see as the benefits of implementing a universal basic income?
Well, the benefit of a universal basic income is that you don't have to have these intrusive questions, so it's more respectful of individual privacy, and a basic liberalism where you shouldn't have to be justifying your circumstances to the state all the time. We also get the benefit of that for those people who are currently facing really high effective marginal tax rates, because these income-linked benefits all abate in that particular income range, so you're getting to keep very little of the next dollar spent. Well, those come down a lot because the universal basic income doesn't get clawed back in that same way. The downside is that to make sure that can happen, everybody else's marginal tax rates go up, and then you've got the trade-off of whether it's better to have a relatively small number of people facing high effective marginal tax rates for some ranges of income, which can actually be hurdled if you flip from part-time work all the way over to full-time work in some cases, whether it's better to have that kind of a setup or to have one where everybody's paying much higher taxes which also will affect people's choices of how much to work and other decisions. So it's your choice of distortions, really. But the harsher trade-off is the one where you just can't afford to provide as much assistance under a UBI as you can with targeted aid. And then if you start layering targeted assistance on top of a UBI to try and provide that kind of assistance to those who are in the worst need, you wind up bringing back a lot of the problems that a UBI is meant to solve, because you're then having, again, high effective marginal tax rates for people who are on those additional income-linked benefits, and you're bringing back the intrusive questions to make sure that the aid is going to the people who most need it. So it brings back a lot of the problems that a UBI is trying to solve.
And so just continuing on with this sort of idea of a hybrid universal basic income with also a welfare system, how would this work? And if universal basic income were introduced, would it be more likely than not that this is how it would happen?
I see it being the only politically feasible way of it happening. If you tried to run a UBI that wouldn't blow out the budget, you would immediately have a lot of people in very sympathetic circumstances on the news saying, well, my income has just gone down by $10,000 a year or more, and here is my kid who's in particularly bad circumstances. Here's the harm that this program has done to me. You'd have, like, every night for a month, Campbell Live specials, and very quickly you'd have a welfare system layered on top of a UBI. I just don't think that it's politically sustainable to have a UBI in the $10,000 to $12,000 a year range that has been kind of talked about, because a lot of people in very bad circumstances are getting more than that. But once you do that, you've kind of defeated the purpose of a UBI.
And obviously there's an election on at the moment, and there's been a bit of discussion around the UBI with the Opportunities Party sort of floating the idea, and Labour also floating it last year. Do you see any future government implementing the scheme, or do you think it's just too costly?
I don't see it on any short to medium term horizon. It's the kind of thing you can imagine possibly coming up if some scenarios for future tech development played out. So I don't believe these scenarios would happen, but here's the scenario that some people worry about. They think that rise of automation and artificial intelligence will mean that a lot more people are unemployed and that the returns to capital go up a lot compared to wages. In that kind of scenario, you could imagine taxes that are more focused on wealth rather than income, and using that to fund a basic income with massive changes in underlying labor markets and technology and how the economy works. I don't believe that's going to happen, because with every prior technological innovation we've had, people find other kinds of work and there's always more jobs to be done. So I don't think that'll play out, but if it did, that's the kind of scenario where I would see a UBI coming in.
Continuing with our work and income coverage, I spoke with beneficiary advocate Miles Lacey about work and income in New Zealand and what it's like to be a beneficiary. I began by asking him about the difficulties beneficiaries are currently facing.
Total inadequacy of how much the benefits pay compared to the cost of living, especially housing.
What kind of disparity is there between how much beneficiaries get and the cost of living?
To give an example, the average house price in Auckland for rent will be around about $550 a week. The highest paying benefit would pay $217 mark in the hand. And even if they got the full accommodation supplement, it still would not come even close to covering the rent.
You've previously worked as a case manager at WINS.
Yep.
What was your experience of this, and how has it sort of shaped your views around beneficiaries?
The main thing it did was it showed me just how totally that any changes are going to happen is going to have to be... It's going to have to involve bringing in work and income staff as well, because I was a beneficiary before I started working for WINS, and I became one after I worked for WINS, and my experience from that was it's pretty hard to explain, but I'd say that it didn't really change my views much about beneficiaries, except that I found out that getting even a smallest amount of change done is very, very difficult with an organisation like WINS, because of just how nasty it is. Very toxic culture on both sides of the desk. Yeah.
National has announced that they'll be implementing further sanctions on beneficiaries who don't meet requirements under the Job Seekers Allowance if they're elected again. How do you think this will affect beneficiaries?
Well, the government's always, the National Party's always promised to crack down hard on beneficiaries. It's just continuing on with the same old thing. It just means that they just put a lot of beneficiaries, especially the unemployed, under a lot more stress. Really, they're just wasting time with sanctions, because no matter how tough the sanctions are, I mean, if there's not enough jobs to put people in, you can't get everybody into jobs. You can't get, and there's never going to be enough job training programs to go around. So I think it's more aiming at those people who don't like beneficiaries much, rather than anything practical that they could do. I mean, with all the sanctions already have, I mean, it couldn't possibly get much worse.
Obviously, there's an election coming up. Do you believe there's been enough discussion around welfare this election?
Actually, there's been quite a lot of it compared to previous elections. In previous elections, it's always been very ho-hum, but this election, it's really shaping up to be quite interesting. And even among beneficiaries, there's a lot of conflict over who to vote for, because quite a few of them, of course, are going with the Greens, but there's also a lot of support for New Zealand First and some for Labour. I think the only party which everybody I've spoken to or communicated with is agreed on is they won't vote for National, and that's about the only thing they're all agreed on. Yeah, it's been quite a bit of discussion this time around, and it's been good.
And do you see any significant changes to work and income coming out of this election?
Not in the short term, no. I think that if, say, a Labour-Green coalition got elected, I think they'll slacken some of the more punitive sanctions, but I think that will be about it. I don't see any major changes as far as work and income is concerned.
And what changes to work and income would you like to see?
I think one of the biggest changes virtually everybody would like to see would be a major improvement in the attitude of the staff towards beneficiaries, and an end to these punitive sanctions, particularly the 13-week stand downs that they impose upon the unemployed.
And how does getting sanctioned affect beneficiaries?
If you think about it, if you get told your benefits being stopped for 13 weeks that you can't get any help from them, that's when you've got people already absolutely destitute and already struggling, that means they end up homeless, they end up without food on their table. So unless they've got family to fall back on, they're basically screwed. Think of it this way, think of what would happen if you didn't have any money coming in for 13 weeks.
This sort of scheme of getting people into temporary work to gain experience. Do you feel this works? Does it motivate people to then go out and pursue job opportunities? Or do most people sort of do the work experience and then go back to work and income?
It depends on how it's handled. Getting people into temporary work works okay, provided that the people who are getting that sort of work are the people. It boils down to this: if they get people who need that work experience into the temporary work, then that will be good. But a lot of the times, the people who end up getting put into those jobs are the ones who don't really need them, because those people will be able to get jobs no matter what the market's like. So it depends on how the government or whoever gets elected deals with it and how they handle it. But any form of work experience has got to be good for you, because it adds up to your skills and experience.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.